You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 140.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
You've reached another Local Maximum. Welcome to the show. Today, we are going to welcome back a guest on the program to talk about why all of these election polls are so tricky. I know I've had a lot in the election recently. We've only got a few weeks to go. He is a data scientist, a developer of PyMC3, and an election modeler at pollsposition.com, which focuses on French elections in France. So we'll have a look at my U.S. election from a distance, perhaps. So let's welcome back to the show, Alex Andora. Hi, Alex. You've once again reached the local maximum. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Max. And I'm worried because it seems like I'm stuck at the local maximum, and usually that's not good.
Hopefully it's a higher local maximum than last time. I don't know. You do a lot of data analysis with polls, and guess what? There's been a lot of interest in that this month.
Ah, really?
What's
happening?
I don't know. I get a lot of requests for this kind of thing. So first of all, but before we go into that, tell me a little bit about what you do. You take polling data. What do you do with this? Remind the audience or tell the audience for the first time what exactly it is that you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's tied actually to the open source development that I do. So I'm going to start by saying that I'm a core developer of two Python packages, which are really great packages, of course, which are called RVs and PyMC. And PyMC stands for Python Monte Carlo.
So
it's a package to do Bayesian or more generally probabilistic programming in Python. And so I do open source development on this package, and I use a lot this package on some models that I do, and some of these models are about electoral forecasting. And so I have this project that I have in France, which is which is called pollsposition.com, and this is a project where I and a bunch of friends are trying to forecast elections that happens in France. And to do that, we use some socioeconomic data. And also, of course, we use polls. And so that's why I guess you were interested to talk again today.
Yeah, so I think this will be a good discussion because I feel like it's hard for anyone to be objective about the U.S. election. But maybe you could be a little more objective because we're not going to get into some of the more specific, I want a more general view of what can and does go wrong and how this time might be different in the U.S., but we're just going to kind of, we're just going to try to understand the field that we're diving into a little bit better here. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, there's been a lot of discussions about the polls for the 2020 election here in the U.S. Can we trust them? A lot of people ask. And people can't even agree on whether the polls were right or wrong in 2016. People thought Hillary Clinton were going to win. The pollsters did. But, some people say, well, the polls were way off. And other people say, well, no, they were just off by a tiny bit and it changed the whole thing. So why is it so hard for people to come to a consensus here? Is it... do you think it's just people trying to spin it either way, or do you think there's actually something more, by the nature of polling and the mathematics and the statistics of it that make it so difficult?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's a bit of both. First, I tend to completely discard any politician that's talking about polls because you have usually a high, selection bias there. They usually talk about the polls that go in their way. Some do that more than others. And it's not only in the U.S. I can assure you in France, we have a lot of that too.
But the media outlets do it too. They'll say a new poll says blah, 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 blah. And really there have been 10 polls on that thing, but they decided to focus on that one.
Exactly, yeah.
And you don't know. I would like them to focus on the one that is that is the best, you know, like, tell me why this is significant. Like, this one has the best methodology, but you almost get that in your head, but that might not be the case.
Yeah. No, it's exactly that. And I mean, you can see that everywhere. In France, it's the same thing. And what's funny also is that in France, sometimes I go to, you know, some French TV media and they ask me about polls in the US. And so often they tell me, oh, okay, it was this last poll. In this last poll, it seems like Donald Trump is having a bump in his popularity, you know, and so on. So it's always very funny. So I think there is a bit of that, you know, this horse race thing that we all have in our brain. You know, we like novelty and we like things that seems new and shocking. So this is this part. And yeah, to go back on my train of thought, I usually discard any politician or any non-data focused media that's talking about polls. And also the second part of that, and that's also why I discard that, it's that basically polling is hard. Polling is very hard and it's not intuitive, you know, it's something that's quite hard to explain, and people usually don't really know how a poll is conducted and how then the different weightings are taken care of by the pollsters and so on. So, but it's because also it's a difficult job and it's a difficult industry, and it's a real challenge to have good polls consistently for all elections and so on. And the problem often is that people have their mind set on how polls are good or not, but they don't know how polls are conducted. So it's also difficult there, because yeah, people tend to have opinions on this, while I think we should not have that strong opinions usually, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to go over some ways, you know, polling might be hard here, mm-hmm. but if I miss something, by all means, let me know. So I guess in the ideal situation, you'd contact a random sample of voters mm-hmm. and you ask who they are going to vote for and they give you an answer. But, well, first of all, even if you do that, you can have random variations just by pure, you know, statistical analysis, just by pure, you know, statistical variability. Yeah. And I think that's what oftentimes the margin of error is only talking about, pure statistical variability.
Exactly.
But there's a couple things that could go wrong even if you get that right. So first, there is no random sample. The sample is never completely random, mm-hmm. and is that a problem? And then secondly, the voters themselves, the people you're contacting, they might not even be voters. They might not be telling you exactly what they're going to do. And, you know, there is a lot of speculation here that Trump voters aren't telling the pollsters their true preference. Maybe some Biden voters are doing the same. I don't know. Is this something that you've seen before, say, in French elections, mm-hmm. or do these problems happen to creep in sometimes?
Well, yeah, all the time. I mean, that's also why it's super hard. And first, I want to caveat all that by saying that I'm in no way a pollster. I'm a statistical modeler, so I use polls, you know, as a raw material in my models, and then I do a bunch of statistical operations on these polls and other data to get some forecasts of the elections. So that being said, I am curious about polls and how they are conducted. And also, what's good is that I don't have any skin in the game. I mean, I don't care if polls, I don't want to say that polls are good or bad, you know, I'm just using polls whether they have some predictive power, you know. So
do you ever look at a poll though and say, ooh, I wish this was conducted a little differently?
Oh yeah, definitely. In France, especially, I do that a lot. But to go back to your original question, so these are really important topics, because as you say, you can't really have a random sample, a true random sample, as you have in the statistics books. So the first, you know, one of the first and obvious ways is that you get some selection bias in how you contact people. I mean, if you use only landlines, then it's a big problem because most of your of the young people, usually they live in the city and maybe they're from poor households and maybe they're from some minority. So then you have a problem because your bias is associated with some demographics in the population. And that's a big problem. So clearly, if you see, honestly, if I see a poll that uses only landline phones, I'm usually more skeptical of it, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing they still do that.
Yeah. So it's good. I mean, what's good is to have a blend, you know, basically. But it costs more because there is this also, you know, polls cost a lot of money. And so someone has to pay for the polls that you see somewhere in the media. And you don't pay for your media outlet usually. So this costs a lot of money. The best is to have, you know, a blend. I love in France, sometimes you have polls that use face-to-face interviews, landline phones, mobile phones, internet. So that's awesome. But that's super rare. And it's really the best institutes, the best pollster that do that. So that's the first kind of bias that you have. But you have also a lot of other biases that are also interesting. And as you say, there is this voter versus just all adults. You know, you have polls that interview the population of all adults and they don't differentiate whether these people will vote or not, and they don't have a model of whether these people will turn out or not. I think it's the US, from what I know, in the US it's quite rare now, and this is usually really well written in the study, and usually pollsters can also do both. You know, they have one poll with all adults and then one poll with the potential voters. But this is super important because
I think they say they either do registered voters or likely voters.
Yeah, exactly. You have LC. You have that. So you have all adults, then you have registered voters, then you have likely voters. So you have to be careful about that. Usually, it's better to use that polls that use likely voters when you're close to the election, like right now, because, well, people know more about whether they will vote or not. And also, but one thing that you have to keep in mind there, it's that this is kind of like a statistical model that pollsters use. You know, they have models of election turnout. And of course, if you do a model, you're having some assumptions. And if you're having some assumptions and these assumptions turn out to be wrong, well, then your polls can have a systematic bias, you know. So you have to be careful about that. But basically, and that's also why Bayesian statistic is super important in elections and election forecasting. Yeah. It's that you have uncertainty sources everywhere that creep in. And so you have really to keep in mind that one poll is really uncertain and you have to look at the average of all of them. And even this average has a lot of uncertainty around it. So really, that's what makes it a very difficult job. And that's also what makes it, I think, a very interesting job. But you have to keep that in mind all the time. And there are also, if you want, I can also talk about, like, I think two interesting challenges here are, well, the non-response bias that we talked about. And you can have that because first, as we say, maybe you selected a subsample of the population where people don't answer to the phone or they don't have the internet. So if they don't have the internet, usually they are quite old. But then if you don't get the old people in your sample, that's a problem. So that's one part. And there is another part that is an interesting part to have in mind. This is called the partisan non-response bias. And this is actually a phenomena that is usually partisans of a candidate tend to not answer polls when their candidate is in a bad news cycle, you know.
Oh, interesting. So if some bad news about your candidate is out, you're not going to be likely to talk to pollsters.
Yeah. Usually they're like, you can see that as they are demoralized for a bit. And so they tend to not want to answer the phone and not want to answer a pollster.
So when the polls go up and down, it might not actually be people changing their minds. It might be just people changing their behavior in terms of whether they're talking to the pollsters or not.
Yeah, and you can actually, you can adjust for that in the models that you do. But that's why it's interesting to have models to forecast the elections, because a model can take all of that uncertainty in consideration, whereas your Homo sapiens brain can't do that, you know, consistently and all the day, all day, you know. So that's why it's interesting to have a model. But yeah, basically, that's why, that's also why, you know, it's important to not overreact to, you know, so-called convention bumps or debate, after debate bumps, etc. Because you have these non-partisan, partisan non-response bias, but you can adjust for that. And also, I mean, it's not, we're not talking at the magnitude of an effect at the magnitude of, I don't know, 10 points. I mean, if a candidate goes from, I don't know, plus 5 to plus 15 after some event in the average of polls, this means there is probably signal there. You know, you have to keep the magnitude of the effect in mind.
Right, right. So you have to kind of, you have to be able to balance between them. I've realized this with a lot of people now, including myself, would ask, like, why I haven't taken any polls, who is being polled? And we used to, like, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we used to get calls all the time to do polls. And now it's like, is it because we're in states that don't matter? But that doesn't make any sense, because even some of the states that don't matter do have polls that come out, and there are national polls, so... Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, well, funny thing, I've never answered any poll either.
so you're messing up your own models, huh?
Yeah. No, but I think it's just, this is one of the funny things of randomness, basically. I think we both live in huge cities with millions of inhabitants. We're probably not in an underrepresented group, and so all of these factors, right, you know, come in. And basically, if you're a white male living in a big city, I think it's quite normal that it's super rare that you're contacted for a poll, because keep in mind that polls usually have samples around 1,000 people, and these 1,000 people are not old people living in New York, because otherwise the poll is really weird. So you do the math. I think it's 20 million people living in New York, and 1,000 people in the sample.
Well, less than that, but we have a metro area.
Yeah.
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 Another strategy we've seen is kind of these like observational and corrective studies. And that's a little bit, you know, you've done it. And I'm not sure how widespread that is. It might be everybody does this, but they kind of attempt to correct for that imbalance. They're like, well, if we don't have, first of all, you do want to have, underrepresented groups. Like you said, you don't want to have, you know, if you have 90% of the population, that's all very similar. And then 10% where they're very, they're just very different types of people, then I think you want to focus on those 10%, because among the 90%, you could probably get a good signal by polling them just a little bit. Mm-hmm. I used to do this in attribution for online marketing, where we were trying to figure out, you know, what people would have done had they seen the ad, or what people would have done had they not seen the ad. And we were, we had to kind of focus on underrepresented groups and that sort of thing. So how common is this practice, first of all? Do all pollsters do this? And what could go wrong there? Because I could tell you in marketing attribution, there was a lot that could go wrong.
So I think you were talking about reweighting practices that pollsters use. And yeah, of course, this is used by every pollsters, I'm guessing. Because as we said in the beginning, basically you can't have a random sample. And polling is more and more difficult because people don't answer the phone anymore. And also just getting people via the phone is not representative. So it's super hard now it's harder to reach people randomly and to reach than a random sample or true random sample of the population. So you have to reweight your sample. So that means that, for instance, imagine that there is 20% of the population of voters that are between 18 and 24, and in your poll you're getting only 10% of the sample of your poll that are between 18 and 24. So that means that you will reweight your poll, and you will basically count as two every person that is between 18 and 24. I'm simplifying a bit, but that's basically what this means. Reweighting, that's quite you know, transparent as a term. It's just that each person between 18 and 24 in the poll will weight as two. So the problem here, there are many of them, of course. Imagine that if only by, you know, chance, you get the 10%, you get the 10% of people between 18 and 24 that have a weird behavior compared to their class of age. Then you're
right,
you're,
just by randomness.
Yeah, you, just by
now
randomness.
Your sample is much smaller because
exactly.
It's not your total sample. It's
yeah.
like just your sample in this group. And
yeah.
even if your total sample you think is enough to be significant, this is
yeah.
this could have some randomness.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
Because if you look like if you're like between 18 and 24, there won't be a lot of them in your poll. And the lower the number, the higher the chance to have outliers. You know, it's like
right.
that.
And if it has a big weight, then that outlier could outlie the
yeah,
whole poll.
Yeah, exactly. If you get there was a story like that in 2016. I think it was a newspaper in LA. I don't remember the name, but that did some polls, and they had I think only one black voter in their sample, and this one black voter that said that he would vote for Trump, which was like super weird because usually the black voters really didn't disliked
yeah.
Trump in the polls. So,
but it was about 8%, so not impossible.
Yeah, and so 10%. that messed up their sample.
Right.
You know, so that's wow. one of the risks. Another risk is that you have to choose which factors you are reweighting on, because you can't reweight on everything. You know, it's like you can't say, yeah, I'm reweighting for this and for that and for that, and we are basically reweighting for every possible factor. That's not supposed
to yeah, that's so, what we were trying to do for attribution, and it got like
exactly
it got crazy.
Yeah, you
yeah,
can't you can't do that. It's like, you know, it's like trying to prove that something is not dangerous. Like you can't prove that something that like I don't know, a chemical has no risk. It's impossible. So
right.
you have to choose which weights which factors you are reweighting. And so this can mess up your polls. Like, for instance, in 2016, one of the conventional wisdom is that polls didn't reweight enough for education. And this is because education has been more and more indicative and predictive of what you're gonna vote for, which party you're gonna vote for. But this is quite new in the US, because before it wasn't as polarized on education, you know, but it seems like it's becoming more and more predictive. And so you have to reweight on education. And if you don't do that enough, then your polls will have some problems, you know. So that's basically at least two of the big problems. But And so this second problem, by the way, is tied to what I was saying earlier. This is basically a statistical model, you know. So you have to make choices and you have to make assumptions, because if you don't make assumptions, you can't have a model. And so if your assumptions are wrong, then you're going to have problems. But the good thing is that then you can go back on your assumptions on the next election cycle and, you know, correct course. So that's how you do science, basically, and that's
yeah.
how you learn.
But then I feel like the next election cycle, they're always like, this time we're right, and then
oh yeah, yeah,
there's still more problems.
Yeah, there is the risk. Yeah, clearly there is a risk, which is fighting the last battle, you know, and overcorrecting your course. And like it's true that if you draw conclusions only on one sample, like, oh yeah, in 2016 we were underweighting for education, so now let's be super aggressive and wait a lot for education. And you only have one election where you had this problem, then probably you were overfitting, you know, and then you could have the inverse problem in 2020, you know. So I'm not sure about that, because if you look at 2018, for instance, like education was super predictive, but this can happen. Like imagine for other, you know, other predictors, but yeah, that's
yeah. We don't know what features are going to come in and out of importance over the years.
Yeah, yeah. That's what makes it a hard job, but an interesting job, you know. But
well, yeah, it makes it interesting too.
Yeah, yeah. But also, what I want to say is that you know, often people are like kind of shocked by these reweightings and so on, you know, and like it's as if you know, you get an unpure poll or stuff like that, you know, like people want the raw version, you know, like an organic vegetables, you know, they want the rawest version possible of the poll. But keep in mind that we have to do that because the raw data is not actionable. You know, because the raw data is bad, the raw data is messy, and you have to do all that precisely because the raw data is not good enough. You know, if the raw data was a pure random sample of the population, then you can be sure that pollsters wouldn't care for all this modeling. You know, modeling voter turnout is super hard, and then reweighting and so on. This is super hard, and it costs money. So you can be sure that they would like not to do that, I guess. So the bottom line is here: answer the polls when you are asked to do. You know.
Can you tell us about, do you know any situations that have come to mind in like France, or where you have done some modeling where things went off the rails a little bit?
Oh yeah. Yeah, of course. First, before talking about that, I have an interesting, quite new and interesting method for statistical modeling that appeared based on this, you know, this problem of random sampling and so on, is a method that was spearheaded by Andrew Gell-Mann, who is one of the most renowned researcher in the Bayesian
sure.
framework, and who is in New York, by the way, at Columbia.
Yeah,
and
Columbia.
So he spearheaded a method called multi-level regression and post-stratification. And so this method basically is designed to balance exactly the problems that we were talking about with polling samples. So basically you get a polling sample, and then what do you do with that? You know, how can you reweight this poll to draw inferences on the true latent support for his party in the population? And basically, just very broadly, you can use you use demographic data in, for instance, each state of the US, and then you do some reweighting and so on based on these demographic data and the sample from the poll, and then you can get inferences and forecasts at the state level, even if your poll was at the national level, for instance. You know. So that's a super nice method. It's really interesting. It does, you have to have nice data, you know, nice polling data, and you have to have really detailed samples from the polls, which basically I can't do in France. You know, I don't have enough detail from the pollsters to apply this method, so I can't do that. But in the US, I think you can, because the details from the pollsters are better. So this was kind of a nerdy detour, but I wanted to mention that because it's kind of a cool,
the audience likes that stuff.
Yeah, it's a cool way, you know. It shows that you can get inventive because you have these drawbacks, you know, from pollings and so on. And then you can, yeah, I mean, it's not lost. You know, it's hard. It takes time, but it's not lost. And so to answer your question now,
Yeah, tell me about a time things went off the rails in France, or some polling got went
yeah
off.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, a funny thing is like one of the biggest shockwave that we have known in French politics recently is in 2002, when for the first time the candidate from the far right party got to the second round of the presidential elections. So presidential elections in France are two rounds, and only the two first of the first round go to the second round. And it never happened that a candidate from an extremist party went to the second round. And it was the first time in 2002, and pollsters didn't really see that in the data, because actually the race was really, really close. Actually, it was like super close between the leftist candidate and the traditional left candidate and the far right candidate. So basically it was like a half a percentage point or something like that, you know, so it's super hard. But this was like a huge shock in French politics, and so pollsters had to react to that. And so now the funny thing actually is that I think they are overcompensating, you know, for that. I did a study about that for Pulse Position, and basically I looked at all the polling averages for all the elections that happened between 2002 and 2017, and in almost all of these elections now the National Front, so the far right party, is overestimated by polls, like almost all the time. So it's probably a sign that pollsters are over compensating for this error, and also because you know, everybody is focusing on that. So I think pollsters also have incentives, you know, to overestimate the far right party, because it's not as bad for them to overestimate the far right party than to underestimate it. And so it's true that if I were a pollster, I would tend to prefer to overestimate the far right party. And so
that was even in the news in the U.S. when it happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember it.
Yeah, yeah. It was like super huge. And so that's an interesting thing. And that's where having a model, and especially a Bayesian model, is interesting. Because, you know, you can put that assumption into the model, and then the model can take that into account. And since there are uncertainty around the polls and around all of your model, then your forecast can account for that. And so actually the last forecasting model that I did, which was in 2019 for the European elections, it took that into account, and it was quite good. I anticipated that the far right would be overestimated, and it was, and the polls were kind of wrong. I think it was quite a big mistake, if I remember correctly. But the model got it right, because you had, you know, this uncertainty around the polls. And also, what's interesting, the same election was that there was a polling error also for the far left party, which was also overestimated, and the model got that right too, because the uncertainty and the polling error was within the historical, you know, bounds of polling errors. So it was, if I remember correctly, something like a 2 or 3 point error. And historically, French pollsters are quite good, you know, and so that means that it's very rare that you have a polling error more than 3 points. So but that means a confidence interval of plus or minus 3. So it's already quite big, yeah. You know. But what's interesting is that they did a huge polling error on the traditional right party, and they overestimated it by 8 points, I think, I remember correctly, which is like super huge.
It's like in a divided election, especially.
Yeah, exactly. So it means that if you put that into historical perspective, it's like more than twice the average historical polling error. So it's super, super large.
Yeah. I feel like we have this issue in the U.S., though, where third-party candidates are often, you know, a month, like before we get close to the election, they actually have very high, they do well in polls. And then as we get closer to the election, their polling just collapses to like 1%.
Yeah.
And I'm never sure like what's going on there.
Yeah, I think it's also because in the U.S., though, voter choice is constrained because you basically only have two parties. I mean, I think you have some, you know, aspirational people that answer, well, aspirational answers to the polls, you know, like people saying, oh yeah, I'm going to vote for, I think it's Jill Stein or something like that, you know, or.
Yeah. Well, I remember last time there was Evan McMullen was running in like Utah and people were like, oh, Utah's not going to vote for Trump. They're going to vote for Evan McMullen. And he was ahead in one poll and then no, not at all. And Gary Johnson was getting 20% in some states, which is like, which would be huge. But like, no, they all dropped sub 5%, 2%, 1%.
And I mean, it's also because I guess my one of my hypotheses would be that people don't want to waste their votes, you know, and they know that it's like super, super rare that there is these kind of things happening in the US. And so maybe they would really like to vote for the third party candidate. But they see that, you know, 15 days before the election, the candidate is at 10% or 12%, you know, and it's quite high, it's quite honorable, but they're like, yeah, but he's never gonna make it, so I have to vote for, I don't know, the Democratic or the Republican candidate, because otherwise I'm just wasting my vote, you know, which is actually not what you want in an election, you know, that's not good that you guys are in this position.
And sometimes, I mean, like here in New York State, I feel like I could do whatever I want because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but but that's a problem, you know. I mean, that's kind of a big problem. You should be able. I think you should be able to vote for whoever you want, you know. And that's
another. We've talked a lot about we've talked a lot about different voting systems.
Yeah, yeah,
we'll
yeah.
We'll have more discussions about that on the in the future.
Well,
but let me talk. Oh, episode 126, I'm going to point back people to but let me just make sure that's correct, because there was one. All right, yes, I talked about the Electoral College in 126, but I talked about other things as well, so a lot of election-related possibilities. All right, so coming back to my first point, you know, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this. If not, we could skip the question, but I've seen people say the polls were way off in 2016, and then I see other people say, well, they weren't that far off. They were just a little sparse in some of the key states like Wisconsin, and it threw everything off. What did you look into this? Like, what is your sense of that?
Yeah. So I think both assessments are true. It's just that we're not talking about exactly the same polls. National polls, they were quite right. They were like, I think the error in the end was 2 points, something like that, which is like better than what they did in 2012. I mean, in 2012, they were off by, I think, 4 points, if I remember.
I feel like that could have been accidentally right, though, you know, because if it's like, if it was up in, if it was overestimating in some states and underestimating in other states, it's like, well, I made one error here and one error there, and they just happen to cancel out.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's why it's interesting to take an average, you know. You're hedging your bets. But at the national level, polls were really not that bad, and actually better than in 2012. The problem is that at the national level in 2012, they predicted the right winner. In 2016, they predicted the wrong winner, and people tend to think, you know, in a binary fashion, and they just look at, oh, okay, they had the wrong winner, so polls were crap, which is not true at the national level. At the state level, though, the situation is much more disparate, and you had, indeed, in some states, they were quite good, but in a few of the key states, they were really, really off. And that's a problem because you vote locally in the US, you vote by states. And so national polls are interesting to get a sense of where the race is at the national level, but they don't account for all the uncertainty and all the correlations between states, you know. So again, that's why a model is interesting, because it takes into account all the correlations between the states and also the electoral college math that you have to do. And so usually you have to pay more attention to state polls. And state polls in 2016, they were off by quite a large margin in some key states. And that was a problem.
All right. Yeah. So the 2020 election here in the US is less than a month away. I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction, don't worry. what are you going to look for in both the polling as they come out in the next couple of weeks and in like earlier election returns, let's say it's election day, what are going to be some of the indications of how things are playing out in terms of, you know, whether the polls are accurate or not, or that will tell us which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there are, I think, several things to say here, but I think usually what I look for is more how are the averages and the models moving. And I usually don't pay that much attention to individual polls, again, because it's more noise than signals, and especially because you have so many polls in the US. I mean, it's impossible to follow all the polls, national, state-level polls, and so on. So what I'm going to look for is there any movements in the averages and in the polling and in the modeling? And a good heuristic here is that every day that passes where Biden is still ahead by 8 or 9 points is a good day for him. Because as you get closer to the election, there is less uncertainty around the voting and around the polls. And so if Biden stays up by 9 or 8 points, this is quite a big lead, and it becomes less uncertain, and it's also mean that Trump has less time to get more ground, you know. So it's really good, and it's really good for him if things stay as they are, you know. Every day
right.
where things stay as they are, it's good for him. And so
it's 2020 though. It's tough to say something can stay where it is for 30 days.
Yeah,
but I would be happy if it were like 2 days to go and nothing's changed. Then
yeah.
if I were Biden, I'd be like, okay, this is
clearly it's not finished, because if I remember correctly, in 2015, at this state of the race, Hillary Clinton was still widely ahead, like less than Biden. So
not only was she ahead, but this is when Access Hollywood tapes came out, and so it was like, oh, now he's going to be even worse. He's totally done.
Then
it was like,
what
happened?
Yeah, but she was at +6 again, which is not as comfortable as +8 or +9, because the Democrats have this systematic disadvantage in the Electoral College. So +6 is good, but if you get to +4, then you get in weird you can get into weird territories, and then if you are at +2, basically it's like 50-50. But
all bets are off.
But +8 is really comfortable, you know, and things are non-linear in probabilities because you have floor and ceiling and so on. So +8, +9, I'd feel good right now. But yeah, still, I think 3 weeks to go, right? So, so we'll see. I think as long as the COVID, as COVID is in the news cycle, this is not good for Trump. So I bet, and if you look at the history of the evolution of the averages and the models in the campaign, they're mainly good for Biden. At the beginning, Biden had a 2-in-3 chance of winning the Electoral College, which was exactly the same probability as Hillary Clinton on Election Day. And then now he has an 85% chance of winning. So it's much better, and he went in, and Trump didn't really made any improvements since then. He always was at 1/3 at best. So honestly, if I had to bet today, I would bet on Biden. Of course, if you allow me to change my bet 2 days before the election, maybe it will change.
It might be different.
But I mean, I'm a Bayesian, so I like to bet and I think in bets. So I would not have any problem. I know you didn't.
I still
ask
think
me
you would agree.
Prediction,
you're not gonna. It's imprudent to veer too far off from 50% at this point. Like, okay, maybe 60-40, but you know.
Oh, you think? I don't think so. I would be more aggressive here.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I mean 8 points is really big, and
yeah.
So honestly, if you ask me that I have to bet today, I would bet on Biden, and I would feel pretty confident in that. I mean, even if the polls are off by 2 points, so like 2016, sorry, this will still be a 6 point lead, which is quite big. I know you didn't ask me for a prediction, but I think predictions are actually really good, and it's good, you know, to do predictions publicly. And I know you do that on the podcast, so I really love that, because I think it's kind of an intellectual laziness of people, you know, going to some media and then saying, oh no, I'm not making a prediction because it's too hard, blah blah blah. But I think this is gonna happen. You know, I mean, this.
But I also don't like it when people make predictions and then they don't come back to it. And say, like, you know, it's just to score points at the time, but then they don't come back to it and say, was I right or was I wrong? And if you're right, then you could say, hey, I told you so. And if it was wrong, it's...
That's why...
You have to examine things.
Exactly. That's how you learn, you know. So that's why it's interesting to do electoral forecasting. So we'll see. Yeah. But if you ask me to bet money today, I would bet on Biden.
What would your spread be if it's not 60-40? How high would you go?
Well, for now, the models have Biden winning between 85% and 90%. So if I hedge my bets, I would say 80-20.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Good to know. Alex, thanks for coming on the show. Any last thoughts on this? And please remind people, you know, where they could find you online.
Yeah. last thought is related to, you know, the polling misses that I was talking about earlier in France. For instance, in the 2019 election, this big miss in the polls for the right party threw off my model for this party. Why? Because the polling error was so huge in historical comparison that basically the model doesn't know what to do. You know, what do you do when you observe such a polling error that you didn't observe before? And so the model doesn't know what to do, but it doesn't know what to do because you wouldn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do? What's the good thing to do in these cases? You know, you should have a huge uncertainty in these cases. So it's really easy to go and say, oh yeah, the polls are crap and the models are stupid and they were completely off in 2016. But this is a hard job. And I think having really set opinions on how polls are good or bad and how models are useful or not is really not warranted here. And I think we would do better if we all had more uncertainty and thought more probabilistically, you know, that would make my days
Agreed.
Easier. And so just to finish on that, I'd be happy to talk about all that with people. They can get in touch with me on Twitter at Alex_Andorra, like the country, tiny little country in Europe. Basically I'm also doing a podcast. You were there, Max, on the Learning Bayesian Statistics podcast, and so people can check that out. The link is on my Twitter, or otherwise you just type Learning Bayesian Statistics in your favorite podcatcher and it should pop up. And
All right, great.
Yeah,
all of that will be on the show notes page, localmaxradio.com/140.
Thanks
we have three more episodes until the election. So if you're getting tired of the election stuff, three more episodes left. That's all you have to get.
Yeah, I am not. Excited. I really love these.
I don't know if I'm going to talk about the election all three episodes, but
yeah.
probably do a check-in. So.
Yeah.
All right. So Alex Andorra, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Max, for having me again.
All right, that was great. I just have two follow-ups from previous episodes. One of the stories that we covered in the last episode was Coinbase. And if you remember, Coinbase gave their employees very, very generous packages to leave the company if they're uncomfortable with the, you know, rules that kind of restricted the political activism in the workplace. And so At the time, only 3 employees have taken it, but Ars Technica now reports that 60 Coinbase employees have taken the severance, or about 5% of the company. It's interesting. Some of those might not have cared about the Coinbase, the new rules. It might have just been that they were incentivized by the really nice package. They might have been like, hey, I could collect double salary for 6 months. Maybe I'll do it. Or maybe they're thinking about, anyone who's thinking about leaving is on the fence. So is that a bad thing? I don't necessarily know. It's a very interesting gamble. It's not clear how it will play out. Will the company have more cohesion after this? Very interesting experiment. So I will continue to follow this, and we'll follow up when we have more to say. Another one is, we talked about the Viking DNA last episode, and I got, well, we were talking about how, you know, some potential stat, or I don't know if it's real, like all Ashkenazi Jews are six cousins or less. And a friend of mine, who actually, he's the one who posted the one on, or retweeted the one on the Viking DNA, so he's interested in that stuff, sent me a Medium article entitled from 2017 saying, no, you don't really have 7,900 fourth cousins. And the article is saying that a lot of these DNA tests will say, if you're an Ashkenazi Jew, that you have a lot of fourth cousins, when really it's not necessarily fourth cousins. It's people who share multiple ancestors, but further up the family tree, so further back in time. That is an interesting idea. There's actually a lot of like interesting mathematics to genealogy, and a lot of interesting things happen when you kind of post people back in time and you kind of look at shared ancestors. I'm sure this is true with other ethnic groups as well. So, maybe I can do a whole episode on genealogy math. That would be pretty cool. All right. So, with that, have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.